We are back on the Bengals Beat podcast. I'm Lindsay Patterson alongside Tyler Dragon, Charlie Goldsmith. How you guys doing?
UCLA is in the Final Four. The Final Four starts Saturday. It's a good day. It's been a good time to be a Bruin. Now, I know I'm a half Bruin, half Bison, but, you know, that half of me that is a Bruin, it's been going well because UCLA, they're having a great Final Four run. And we'll see what happens against Gonzaga. We'll see. So, yes, I'm doing good. How are you two doing?
Tyler, I've been impressed with how your Twitter account has turned into a college basketball, NCAA tournament, and NBA draft account. It's been a fun week, little vacation there on Twitter. I've enjoyed your takes.
Yeah, you know, it's not all football for me. Football, basketball, and track and field. Those are my three sports. So if you follow me on Twitter, you'll get some track and basketball takes every now and then. Just wait for the Olympics, Charlie, when I tweet about track all the time.
No, I'm ready for it. And obviously that connection with UCLA and Mick Cronin, we can talk about that a little bit later. And another connection, pro days are in the books almost. You got Ja'Marr Chase already. Everybody was able to see his impressive pro day. You got Sewell happening pretty much in the next hour or two as we're recording this podcast on a Friday. Poor timing on my end. This is what we're talking about right now, because I feel like at the moment, all we do is talk about the number five pick ever since the season ended for the Cincinnati Bengals. And I feel like it's 50-50 right now when you look at Bengals Twitter and what fans want or where the team's going to go. What are they going to do at number five? And who should it be as of today, less than 30 days out?
Who should it be as of today? Well, so I tweeted about this earlier this week, and I said if I played the GM for all five teams selecting one through five, if I were the Jacksonville Jaguars GM, I would select Trevor Lawrence. If I played the GM for the New York Jets, I would not select a quarterback. I think Sam Darnold needs weapons around him, so I would select Ja'Marr Chase. 49ers, they've pretty much showed their hand. They want a quarterback. I like Jimmy Garoppolo still a little bit, but since they showed their hand and they believe quarterback is the position that they need, I would draft Justin Fields if I were the 49ers. Now, Falcons pick four. I would draft Kyle Pitts if I was the Falcons GM. Now the Bengals. If I'm the Bengals and I was their GM, we all know they don't have a GM, but if I played their GM, I would draft Penei Sewell. Now, I personally think the Bengals should draft Sewell, because if protecting Joe Burrow is your number one priority, which they have said on and off the record, then you have to show it with your actions. And I still don't believe that they have all the way solidified and stabilized that offensive line. And also, let's not forget that Penei Sewell is an excellent run blocker as well. He had, 58 pancake blocks in 2019 as a sophomore. So drafting him, that also helps your running game. And oh yeah, don't forget you have Joe Mixon in the back grill. So upgrading your offensive line with Penei Sewell not only helps the passing game, protects Joe Burrow, but the guy that you're drafting, if you end up drafting Penei Sewell, he's an excellent run blocker and can block for a running back like Joe Mixon. Now, I get that a lot of people want Ja'Marr Chase, and if he's available, they're at five. Joe Burrow's former teammate at LSU, they, you know, made history together. I think Ja'Marr Chase is going to be a really good NFL wide receiver. I think he has the ability to be a number one receiver. But if I am looking at the Bengals roster, I do not believe that they need a number one receiver. Tyler Boyd and T. Higgins caught 146 passes combined and had over 1,700 yards last season. And that was playing for Joe Burrow for just 10 games. So you only have one football to go around. So at receiver, you need probably a third option at receiver. Yes, you still need a receiver, but you have option one and option 1A or option B at receiver already. So if you have a Ja'Marr Chase, yes, that is a great receiving core. And I've said this in podcasts and in my articles that those three together might make for the best wide receiving core in the AFC North. But that is not a bigger need than the offensive line. And that doesn't feel what the Bengals' most glaring weakness is. And if you have Penei Sewell and you have Jonah Williams on one side, you have stabilized left tackle and right tackle for years to come. And Riley Reiff only signed a one-year deal, so the Bengals aren't invested a lot in him. So if it were me, I would draft Penei Sewell. There you go.
My favorite thing to go back to is what has changed since the Bengals season ended? What has changed since we knew the Bengals would have a top five pick, then learned that it would be the number five pick? And what has changed since Joe Burrow's injury? Well, two things really have changed. Some have been in the Bengals' control and some haven't. I'll start with what hasn't. And what hasn't changed, or excuse me, what wasn't in the Bengals' control was that all of a sudden the number five pick might be more valuable than it was even a month ago. It wasn't in the Bengals' control that the San Francisco 49ers went up and traded for the third pick. As a result, especially if they take Mac Jones, more trade back options could be on the board at five, but also more high impact players could be available if they keep the pick. Now, the thing that hasn't changed that was in the Bengals' control is their two biggest needs, wide receiver and offensive lineman, whether you want to say it's a guard or a tackle. The Bengals in the offseason, surprisingly, kind of went all in on defense. They needed a pass rusher. They got one, but also they added a lot of depth into the defensive back room and really prioritized that side of the ball without addressing in a significant way depth at wide receiver and offensive line. They added Riley Reiff, but they didn't necessarily build as much depth as they could have or fill all five locked in starter spots on the offensive line. And then at wide receiver, of course, Auden Tate is their number three guy right now. So that's kind of how we got here, heading into a draft where the Bengals have a huge need at wide receiver and have a huge need on the offensive line. For me, though, despite that being the case, nothing has changed from Joe Burrow's injury, from what stands out to me is the Steelers game where there was the Penei Sewell sign on Paul Brown Stadium, and it was just that obvious then. It's still that obvious to me now. It's also clear that they need help at receiver. That's why I would have been more proactive addressing that spot in free agency. But nothing has changed that Penei Sewell is the best lineman they had a realistic chance to get this offseason. And I think that's just the direction to go.
See, this is where I disagree with you guys. And I will agree, obviously, protecting Joe Burrow is the number one priority going into this offseason. Ever since he went down against Washington, they needed to actually do it when they drafted Joe Burrow. They went heavy in free agency on defense. We've talked about that plenty of times. They did it again this year, and they did that prior to last year. I think you get Frank Pollock in there as new offensive line coach. I think Riley Reiff, yes, it's a one-year deal, but you add him, he makes your offensive line a little bit better. And when you look at this draft class, a lot of people want to throw out, oh, the wide receiver class is deep. And the offensive line class is deep. I feel like the offensive line class is deeper. And if you look at some of the mock drafts out there and you look at some of the prospects who are going to be taken, it's going to be loaded with quarterbacks. This team has a chance to get an offensive line starter at 38 in the second round. Yes, they should still prioritize protecting Joe Burrow. That's why I feel like the first, second, and third pick are going to be offensive related for the Cincinnati Bengals all those rounds. I still think they need to look at the wide receiver room. Yes, a lot of people say T. Higgins isn't getting enough credit out there, but if T. Higgins or Tyler Boyd goes down, they're screwed at the wide receiver position. So I don't even think you need the number one receiver and what Ja'Marr Chase would be able to do on the field.
I think you have to look at that room and just see who can we take now? Who's going to be a game changer for this offense? And you still draft an offensive line player, because as we know from last season, the draft doesn't end after the first pick. The Bengals had a pretty good draft in 2020. I think they could do that again. But again, it's going to be offensive line heavy for the Cincinnati Bengals in the second round, and maybe even the third if they see a starter there. If not, they'll get best player available. But that's just my opinion right now. When you look at the room as of today, as of April 2nd today, before draft night on April 29th on a Thursday night, I sage Ja'Marr Chase.
So let me ask you this. How many catches do you think Tyler Boyd is going to have next year?
Oh, that's a great question. I think they're going to be able to split it up.
No, but so
you can't have enough playmakers out there. Look, I know Joe Mixon. Can. I know Joe Mixon's coming back. People want to throw out CJ Uzomah. The guy's coming off an Achilles injury. Yeah, you get Drew Sample, who was involved a little bit more last season in the offense, but in the wide receiver room, not tight end room, not running back room, wide receiver room alone. I'm thinking about injuries. I'm thinking about this team has yet to have that third wide receiver. No offense to AJ Green, because he was coming off injuries. John Ross has not been a factor since he's been in Cincinnati. A little bit is playing time, and a lot of it has been injuries. He's no longer with the team. And you can't point at Auden Tate and say, yep, he's the red zone guy. He's going to be that third receiver. And even having Mike Thomas as more of an insurance wide receiver right now. Yeah. I don't even think you have to say it. Like, even if you look at the wide receiver room and say, you get Chase, he's going to be the number one guy. What does that mean for Tyler Boyd? You get Tyler Boyd, T. Higgins, and Ja'Marr Chase, young receivers in that room for at least 3 years together, to be determined if they extend Tyler Boyd after his contract is up. But I still think it's important when you look at the draft, not even getting best player available, because you can look at other positions and say, oh, that would be perfect. No, you get the one, a need this team needs, and they still need a wide receiver. And yes, someone on the offensive line, I'm not going to say that they're going to ignore that and not focus on that the rest of the draft. Look, they should have added more offensive line pieces in free agency. I will say that. They've never looked at the guard position and valued it. It's all been tackle. Willie Anderson just said that recently. It's just a tackle position for them. And they just decided, hey, we can pull Quentin Spain out there, move him over to left guard, and you can still get a starter, even if you decide to draft a tackle in the second round and shuffle the offensive line around a little bit and move one to guard while Riley Reiff plays out his 1 year there in 2021. I just think it's important to look at the playmaker and how he's going to change this offense. Yes, offensive line is important. I can't say that enough, because anytime I say Ja'Marr Chase, it gets brought up. Well, Joe Burrow can't throw balls if he's on his back. Yes, I know. But I feel like their offensive line got a little bit better in free agency, but now they've got to focus on it the rest of the draft if they go Ja'Marr Chase.
So we obviously disagree, and that's fine. That's good. To me, I think tight end is a bigger position of need than a number three or third option wide receiver. Now, if Kyle Pitts was available, I think in my opinion, that is a better argument. Now, I think the Bengals offensive line got slightly better, but not enough where I'm comfortable with. If I'm the GM, or even if I'm Joe Burrow. Now, I haven't talked to Joe Burrow. He just has not said this. I'll make that clear. But I would not feel like my offensive line is as good as it can be. And to this day, right now, the Bengals have the worst offensive line in the AFC North. The worst. Still, so
that's fair.
You need, they're not, can we both, can we all agree on that?
Yes.
It's certainly not better than the Ravens, even if the Ravens trade their tackle. Definitely not better than the Browns. And I want to say their offensive line is better than the Steelers. Do the Bengals have the worst offensive line in the division?
Yes, I would say so.
Would you say so, Charlie?
Pittsburgh's still like making final moves. They just don't have a finished product on the offensive line yet. So I'll take a we'll see on that one.
Okay. Well, in my opinion, the Bengals have the worst offensive line in the division. And I don't even think it's really that close. So if you draft the best offensive lineman available, I not only think that helps your passing game, but that helps your running game. And there's some good receivers that could be available in the second round. So we'll see. I mean, I do think that, you know, like I said, offensive line is their biggest position of need. But wide receiver is a position they need to, but so was that tight end position. I don't think that could not be lost. The Bengals had one of the worst tight end position groups production-wise in the NFL last season. Kyle Pitts can certainly change that. I don't know if he's going to be available at 5, but we'll see. There's a lot of unknowns about this year's draft with the number 5 pick. Last year, I knew who the Bengals were going to draft in November, December. Right now, they're keeping their cards close to the vest, and they don't have the number 1 pick, so they have to kind of wait and see what's going to happen. And we think there's going to be a flurry of quarterbacks drafted, at least 1 through 3. So it's going to be interesting come later this month.
There are so many layers to this Sewell Chase conversation. It goes way beyond the first round and into free agency. It is just so clear that wide receiver and offensive tackle are both huge needs for the Bengals right now. And what's, I guess, tantalizing is that they could address either of them in the first round. I'm still in the Sewell camp. The reason is, you know, and the more I dive into the second round offensive line class, Lindsay made this point, and I do agree that if you took Chase at 5 and a tackle at 38, that would be more talent than taking Sewell at 5 and the corresponding wide receiver at 38. I think the Bengals would gain more overall talent points there. But it's more important to me that you get the better offensive lineman at 5 in Sewell than getting the better wide receiver comparatively to what you could get at 38. It's the biggest position of need, critical importance, what's changed since December. But that just underscores again how free agency and specifically the lack of depth provided at wide receiver and on the offensive line is now shaping this conversation. The thing I do agree with Lindsay with, and, you know, Tyler, you're a big basketball guy. You know, who's saying that Kyrie Irving's the third option in Brooklyn? He's Kyrie Irving being Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn, things like that. When these super teams are created, you never worry about there only being one ball. And I feel the exact same way about football. I think in a lot of ways, basketball has paved the way to having that conversation about playmakers in football as well, where it's not a zero sum game at some point. There aren't diminishing returns. And while Jamar Chase isn't Kyrie Irving, isn't going to be a top 15 player in the NFL right away, the opportunity cost in the add-on of having him in the offense is still huge. That's why I would have been more proactive in getting a wide receiver in free agency. So then you could have been locked in and being proactive in your offensive line in the first round. The Bengals still have a glaring need of wide receiver. And that's why I think the Jamar Chase argument carries a lot of weight. It's just not the biggest overall way to address the Bengals' biggest flaw.
I gotta say something about all these points. So the basketball analogy, I get what you're saying. Kyrie Irving is Kyrie Irving, but Kevin Durant's been out for 2 months. So we'll see what happens when he comes back. And we saw what happened when the Miami Heat had a big three. Chris Bosh had to take a back seat, and Chris Bosh is a Hall of Famer. So I don't think that, in my opinion, is a very good analogy, because the Brooklyn Nets are dealing with injuries. And so back to the football field, the Kansas City Chiefs lost the Super Bowl because they could not protect the best quarterback in the NFL and arguably the most talented quarterback we have seen. That's why they lost the Super Bowl. They could not protect him. He was running for his life out there. And how many weapons does Patrick Mahomes have? He had a whole lot of weapons. He couldn't get them the ball. Tyreek Hill would be the best receiver on the Bengals. Travis Kelce would by far be the best tight end on the Bengals. He couldn't give him the ball because he was running for his life. So, okay, draft all the receivers, the skill positions you want. And if Joe Burrow's running for his life, it's not going to matter. It is not going to matter. The Patriots lost their undefeated season to the New York Giants. Why? Tom Brady was running for his life in the Super Bowl. And that Giants defensive line ate the Patriots offensive line to death. And that's why they lost the Super Bowl. Tom Brady could not get the ball to the second best receiver of all time, Randy Moss. So draft all the skill positions you want, but if you can't protect the quarterback, it's not going to matter.
And Tyler, we're on the exact same page there. I am as aggressively in the Sewell at five camp as you can be. I'm just trying to paint a broader picture of how the Bengals attacked this offseason. The Bengals' biggest priority this offseason was defense, and that priority even superseded the fifth pick in a lot of ways. Because if the Bengals would have addressed one of the areas that the Bengals could go in with the fifth pick, they would be able to, I guess, have a more clear-cut answer for the best possible use of that resource at five. But since instead the Bengals went so aggressively on their defense, they're only going to be able to address one of those areas in a big way. And I'm just pointing out that that is something I project to be an issue. The bigger issue is offensive line. Again, I'll keep saying it. Nothing has changed since December. But again, the Bengals in a lot of ways set themselves up to have a hole now at either offensive line or wide receiver. And I don't think they should have been in that position in the first place.
No, and those are all valid points. And like I mentioned before, obviously you can point to the Super Bowl and say, you know, they would have won if they had a better offensive line. They were dealing with injuries. Two of their best players were out for the Chiefs offensive line. And I think you could say the same for Cincinnati Bengals. If they do not address the offensive line, which they messed it up. Two free agency periods, they didn't do it. And I think they aren't going to ignore it in the second round if they decide to go to Ja'Marr Chase. I don't think the Bengals can go wrong with the number five pick if they stay at number five. I think it's a win-win for Joe Burrow in this offense. But if you're the Cincinnati Bengals right now and you have four teams in front of you and say all four of them choose quarterbacks, you have all the leverage in the world because you have your quarterback. If you are the Bengals right now, are you trading out of that pick?
That is a really good question. Now, so we all know the Bengals have won the fewest games in the NFL in a 2-year span. So they obviously have a lot of holes. If you trade down and possibly get two first rounders or trade down to get more assets in later rounds, that is something I believe the team should strongly consider if they do get an offer like that. However, it's important to get the player that you are targeting. I can't stress that enough. So in the first round, for instance, if you're targeting Penei Sewell, he's the number one player in your board, or you're targeting Ja'Marr Chase or targeting Kyle Pitts, and one of them is available at the number five pick, get the player that you want, that you believe is going to help rebuild and change your franchise. But if you get an offer, say trade down and get two first round picks, and you like Rashawn Slater, who can play guard, and you get maybe a pick in the 20s, okay. That I think that is a good way to go as well, because then you can get still a quality player at the 20-30 range or whatever, and still get maybe a first-round caliber offensive lineman. That's just, you know, hypothetically speaking. But at that five pick, if it were me, I would stay there if the number one player on my board was available and right there for the taking at five. I would stay there and get the player I want.
Yeah, I mean, you have to be very confident in the options you are going to have on the table when you get to that trade back pick. That's what I love what the Dolphins did. They moved back to six and still pretty much know they're going to get a guy they wanted. I would expect Smith or Chase to be there at six. So the Bengals kind of have to be in a similar position where wherever they go, they have to still be confident that they can get a high-level player, wide receiver, or offensive tackle in my mind, of course, offensive tackle will be the bigger priority. I've said this all along. My board for the Bengals has been and will be Sewell, Chase, Slater, Smith, Pitts. If they can still get one of those players and add assets along the way and address what they see as their biggest need, there wouldn't be as much of a downside there comparative to, say, what the Eagles did moving all the way back to 13.
For me, it's important to listen to the phone calls. Last year, they weren't listening. They were going to get Joe Burrow, and I'm sure their phones were ringing nonstop, but they weren't. We knew they were going to stay at number one this year. I'm sure they're listening to some of the offers and weighing them, but they're not known for doing this. So I think they're going to stay at five and they're going to get the number one guy on their board. But Joe Burrow, some news out of Paul Brown Stadium this week. The Bengals, with a little tease, he was walking on the football field with the trainers and a bag of footballs. What do we know about Burrow and his injury update right now?
So I say this because of when I saw the video, I was shocked how many people were like, Joe Burrow's throwing. Oh, my goodness. He's walking. He's putting weight. I was like, wait. And you know, you two know I don't check my Twitter timeline and my mentions that often. But I do occasionally. And apparently, I guess other writers have not given Joe Burrow updates enough. Or I haven't repeated myself over and over again. So I'm going to do it once again in this podcast so everybody has a up-to-date, to-the-minute Joe Burrow update. So Joe Burrow had left knee surgery on Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020, in Los Angeles. He is now 17 weeks post-operation. I tweeted that out too. That is 4 months and 1 week. Every single Wednesday is a new week for Joe Burrow. It marks a new week. So next Wednesday, it'll be 18 weeks post-operation for Joe Burrow. In February, he started light linear running. In late February, early March, he started throwing. Nothing strenuous. He wasn't dropping back, throwing bombs, planting on his plant leg. None of that. It was just cautious, very light, you know, throwing, nothing too hard. His recovery timeline for his type of injury is 9 to 12 months. He tore his ACL and other ligaments in his knee. And it takes 9 to 12 months for his type of injury to heal and for him to be on a football field and take hits to that knee. Now, 9 months is the short end of that timeline. 9 months from December 2nd will be right around the season opener. Joe Burrow's goal, what he has said publicly and privately, that he wants to be ready by week one. There's a ways to go from now until then. He's not even at the 5 month mark yet. And you know, he's still gradually progressing, and the Bengals, Zach Taylor said this, and other people have said, his trainers, they like the way he is recovering, but there is still a long road to go for his recovery, and he is not at the 5 month mark yet. Now, the Bengals want to be extremely cautious with him. That is why you don't see a whole lot of videos. You're not seeing him throw passes. You're not seeing him running around. They want to protect him. They did not do that with AJ Green. They, in 2019, when AJ Green hurt his ankle, they were a lot of times where Zach Taylor, not to call him out, but, you know, the coaching staff and players said, oh, yeah, AJ Green is going to be ready by week three, week four. It was week 16, week 17. There's still no AJ Green. They prematurely put timelines on AJ Green and his ankle never really healed and never really was able to, you know, get back to a point where he was comfortable to be back in the field in 2019. So they don't want to make that same mistake with Joe Burrow, a player that they believe is their franchise quarterback, and they want him to be healthy and in Cincinnati for years to come. So they're not going to prematurely rush him back or announce any dates of when he is expected to return until they know 100% that he is going to be on the field. And they don't even know 100%, and Joe Burrow doesn't even know 100% that he will be on the field by week one. That's what they want, and that's what he wants, and he is working towards that, but it is impossible to know at this point if he will be in the field by week one. But that is his goal, and that is the Bengals' goal. So I hope I have cleared that up for everybody. Y'all have a minute-to-minute timeline of Joe Burrow's status and where he is at right now. Oh, and he is in Cincinnati. He trains at Paul Brown Stadium sometimes, and also Black Sheep Performance in Blue Ash.
This reminds me some of just the conversations we had on this podcast in July and August last season about Joe Burrow. Even then, when he wasn't recovering from an injury, we weren't getting week-to-week updates of when he's throwing and when he's running and when he's working on X, Y, Z. And then this recovery timeline puts, of course, a whole new wrinkle into it, something that's even more that can fluctuate even more, something that can change day to day, something that in a lot of ways even reminds me of a baseball pitcher, how the timeline can be kind of a fickle thing that goes kind of one day at a time. And that's where we're at with Joe Burrow. It's not exciting. Now, what could get frustrating, and not frustrating, but what could get more of a topic of conversation is if we get to August and it's still this day-to-day timeline where we're trying to figure out exactly where Joe Burrow is at as we get to more of the tipping point of his recovery. But at this stage, again, we weren't tracking day-to-day what Joe Burrow was doing last offseason, and it's very difficult to do the same this offseason as well.
And we even talked to Joe Burrow back in January, and I have a feeling we won't talk to him again until the OTAs all start up, which will be soon. I expect to start out virtually and then maybe in person. And he preferred that they go in person so he could see his teammates. Obviously, he admitted that he probably wouldn't be ready to throw during that time, but he wants to see, you know, his guys run routes. So like Tyler said, I mean, it's to be determined. You have to take it week by week, month by month. But right now we're sitting in April 2nd and that opener's still a long time from now. And there's important hurdles that he'll have to cross week by week. So to be determined, we will have the latest on Joe Burrow and the rehab and then when Bengals get back to work for their offseason program. They made a signing this week, Mike Daniels. They obviously still need all the depth in the world on the defensive line. And still I see them drafting maybe mid late round another guy, another possible starter to add to the defensive line. What do you think about the Mike Daniels bringing him back?
I think it's a good move. The Bengals coaching staff, they liked his leadership. He was a great teammate in the locker room, and he's going to add depth behind DJ Reader and Larry Ogunjobi. He is a player that can play the one technique and the three technique as a defensive tackle. Former Pro Bowler when he was a Green Bay Packer. Obviously doesn't play at that level anymore, but it's a good re-signing for the Bengals. Gives some depth in the interior of the defensive line.
He brings just a lot to the table. He was one of my favorite people to hear from on Zooms last season, and just projecting a role. I do wonder how the Bengals manage their defensive line next season compared to last season. You know, you remember last year they kind of had the third down squad that would run out on third downs. That was Geno Atkins' role. I wonder if Mike Daniels fills Geno Atkins' role this season, since it looks like Ogunjobi is going to be a starter. That's what the Bengals signed him to do, as a three technique tackle. So if Mike Daniels comes in on third downs to push the pocket from the inside, or whether or not they try to use him more as a run guy early, I think though that pass rush style is what he showed he was better at last season. So that's kind of a way I think they could get him snaps.
I have to admit, I did chuckle every single time the Bengals trotted out Geno Atkins and even Carlos Dunlap earlier in the season every third down. It was amazing to see. It was very fascinating to see the two of the best defensive linemen in Bengals history be relegated to third down specialists. But that's where the Bengals were last year.
It was literally a changing of the guards too. It was hilarious because often they'd bring in Logan Wilson and another linebacker. And maybe they'd make one change in the secondary too. So it'd be like an entire hockey substitution going on with the defensive linemen coming in within the linebackers and then the guys running off the field. So that always was a fun moment on third downs.
A little bit of musical chairs on the Bengals defense, just like their offensive line. All right, we've gotten to it. Questions of the week. Where are we at, Tyler and Charlene? Who wants to go first?
We'll have Charlie go first, since Charlie offered up a question of the week well before this podcast. So Charlie, you kick it off.
Tyler, of anyone in the city, I'm most interested to hear your perspective on Mick Cronin, because you got here after he left UC. So you missed the very high highs and the also rockiness between the relationship between Mick and the UC fan base. You just know him as a UCLA fan. So I want to give you the floor. Choose your words very carefully. How do you think Mick Cronin does as a coach?
So I'm judging him based on being a UCLA guy and, you know, being born in California. You know, UCLA, their style of basketball and LA style of basketball, it's showtime, and you want to be able to get the top recruits. And it's just a style of basketball that's different in LA. And you can go from college basketball even to the Lakers. But for college basketball, UCLA has historically been one of the A-listers, a blue blood program. When I was in school there, they went to two straight Final Fours. Now, this year, Mick Cronin, it took a lot for me to kind of, you know, get high on him, because one, I don't think UCLA is getting the level of recruits that they should. California is a hotbed for basketball talent, and I don't believe that they're getting the best players that they possibly can in the state and around the country, because it's UCLA. But he has shown during this NCAA tournament run that his style of play can be successful in college basketball. So the jury's still out on him, but right now he is making me a fan of him and how he plays, because I think his style of basketball is better suited for the NCAA tournament as opposed to the regular season. However, I do want to see him next year, the year after that, and years come, get better players to come to UCLA. Because when I was in school, it was Russell Westbrook, Kevin Love, Aaron Aufalo. Those were the players. And, I mean, before my time, Lou Alcindor, Bill Walton. So UCLA has a historic program. I'm not breaking any news. We all know. So it's about getting championships and at least going to the Final Four. So I'm happy for him that he's been able to go to the Final Four, but consistency is key. Consistency is key.
So what I'm hearing is a great coach who has successful results, but needs to adapt with this style of play and get better recruits. It's funny how that's the exact same things that UC fans were saying about him 2 years ago.
I won't call him a great coach yet. I think great is a strong word, but he's
into the program.
Yeah, he's doing pretty good. But those questions about him being at UCLA, in my opinion, still exist, because there's a style of basketball that UCLA is known for. And he's bringing a totally different style of basketball. Hopefully that's going to attract better recruits, but we'll see. We'll see. I'm giving him a longer leash than I gave him before.
Are they going to win the whole thing?
No. I'm all about school spirit, but I'm also a realist. And Gonzaga is the best team that I have seen in college basketball in a while. The way they play, the way they move the ball, their defense. I think UCLA is going to have their hands full on Saturday.
All right, Tyler, get to your question. Man, we got a little hoop action on here. No, I'm excited for you. That's awesome. UCLA in the Final Four.
So now we're going to switch to the diamond. And we all know opening day was yesterday. You two have been on the Reds since probably birth. I'm asking you two, as Cincinnati natives, Lindsay, I saw you tweet this and say this a lot. You said that Cincinnati has the best opening day. So I want you and Charlie to explain to me and to our listeners, who maybe some don't live in Cincinnati and don't know about Cincinnati's opening day, explain to all of us why Cincinnati has the best opening day in baseball.
Okay, I will start here. And I feel like you can point to a lot of things, because every opening day I feel this way about Cincinnati. And it's because of people who aren't from here. And they're the ones I talk to who have experienced opening day in other cities. And I said, what's that like? Does this city shut down? And obviously you don't get excused from work, but it's one of those days where when you're a kid, you probably don't go to school that day. When it's a normal year, we obviously have the opening day parade. There's a lot of events that are happening, and we got kind of back to it yesterday, and it's not there yet, but you know, in a couple of years, I feel like it'll be the same old opening day. It's just that day is the day you think this Reds team is going to do it all, win it all, you know, go to the World Series. Baseball is back. Fans are getting back into the stadium. And normally in a normal year, it's a sold out stadium. Maybe the one time of year, unless they're in postseason, that it's hard to get a ticket on opening day. And even if you're not at the game, you could still be outside the stadium and enjoying the atmosphere that day. And everything's different about it, because game two is tomorrow of the series and the second game of the season. It's not going to feel like that or anything, but it just, it's hard to explain. But when other people are experiencing it and they're not from here, they all feel the same way. They say it's just different in Cincinnati. I know that doesn't really explain a whole lot, but it's just good. It's an atmosphere thing. Cincinnati knows how to put on an opening day. Winning the postseason, not so much.
There's a history component to it too. Tyler, you may know this, and if you do, I apologize, but Cincinnati was the first professional baseball team, and as a result is the only team in the major leagues that is home every year on opening day. So there's literally no other city that has that tradition of starting the season at home every year. And of course, there's the parade. Everyone kind of has their favorite part of the opening day experience. My favorite part yesterday was seeing people rush to their favorite restaurant in the stadium, or seeing people get to their favorite spot in batting practice where they know they can get a ball, or taking family photos. There's a familiarity to it and a longing to it that just really stands out to me.
Okay. Well, good to know. I did know the Reds were the first baseball franchise, but thanks for telling our fans who maybe don't know. So my second question of the day, well, it's a two-part question. Lindsay, you kind of hinted at your answer already, but the first part is, will the Reds make the playoffs this year? And I want a World Series prediction. Who will represent the two leagues in the World Series?
Oh my goodness. Okay. Well, we've talked about this plenty of times, and I've talked about this outside with just other sports people in town when we talk about the Cincinnati Reds in 2021. I don't think they make the postseason. I think the season will be fun to watch because there are a lot of young guys on this team who are going to make it a fun club. But at the same time, I don't pick them as the best in their division right now, or even in a wild card position. So I'd say no. And World Series prediction, I'm not ready for that. It's like the second game of the season.
People make World Series prediction before game one.
I know, but I'm not ready for it. I'll say the Dodgers are definitely going to win the World Series again. That's what I'll say. How do you like that?
Hey, I got no qualms with that.
This is an easier question maybe for me to answer, because I made on the record predictions in our special edition of the Cincinnati Inquirer, our opening day preview. I have the Reds finishing 81-81. A lot comes back to the lack of activity in the offseason and the way that they weren't able to address their biggest needs and replace some extremely important players and shore up the defense. But the reason to be optimistic about the Reds is while they didn't do that in the offseason, they had a very aggressive spring training, finding a prospect who turned out to be very much ready in second baseman Jonathan India, and now might be their most interesting hitter. Because, you know, no one's really done what he's done, what he's doing for the Reds since 1988. In addition to that, you know, Senzel and Castellanos both had the best spring trainings they've ever had. Same with Luis Castillo, who I know struggled yesterday, but I think he's still going to be a very strong number one pitcher this year. So they have talent. I think it's going to come down to how aggressive they're willing to be at the trade deadline to address some of those weaknesses. Because as we saw yesterday, the Reds aren't a perfect team, but they are a team with talent. And World Series prediction, I have the San Diego Padres over the Chicago White Sox.
Oh, I like it.
Wow.
Little change there. And Charlie's going to be our guy. He's going to be our baseball guy, the one you want to follow. He'll have you covered. He's doing a great job already. He was out in spring training with the Reds and covered his first opening day for the Cincinnati Inquirer and absolutely killed it. I know he's going to have some great pieces, so you're going to want to check all of that out. And Tyler and Charlie will have you covered when we get ready for NFL draft weekend coverage. That'll be here soon in a little under 4 weeks now. I know I had the days down since we got to Monday. We were about 30 days away. So we're getting there 4 weeks from 4 weeks from Thursday. And we'll have plenty to talk about on Cincinnati.com. But what else is up there, guys?
So I have a piece on Larry Ogunjobi and why and how Geno Atkins became his mentor. As we said before, Mike Daniels re-signed this week. Have a story about that. And every single re-signing this free agency period. And also the Bengals extra this week is the Bengals, my prediction of the Bengals draft board at that number 5 pick and who they should draft. I gave you a huge hint earlier this podcast, but I also have 4 other options as well. So check that out. It's going to be up this weekend.
Now that we're into draft month, I'll have more Bengals coverage coming soon, but I do hope you get the chance to check out a feature I wrote on Derek Johnson. He's the Reds pitching coach. He's considered one of the very best in baseball. And I told his story of how in his first job, he was making much less than $12,000 a year, sleeping on a training room table in the clubhouse and doing the laundry and raking the infield. And eventually he became one of 2 pitching coaches in the National League with no professional playing experience to make it to where he's at.
Make sure you check it out, Cincinnati.com, over on Twitter, ENQ Sports, and Instagram, ENQ Bengals. Thank you for listening to the Bengals Beat Podcast.